It was the winter of 1897 when winter came early in the Arctic waters off Alaska's coast. Eight American whale ships were caught off guard, and their ships, along with their 300 sailors, were locked in the ice with no means of escape. Today we talk about the incredible story of the three men who were sent to rescue them. Author Martin Sandler joins us, and the title of his book sums it up, The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an amazing Arctic adventure. Welcome back to the program, Marty.
Thank you.
All right, so set the scene for us. Arctic waters, freezing solid, no ship is getting in there, never mind out to rescue these guys. And at this point, there had never been an overland rescue. This is not a pleasant place to be in the winter.
To this day, there's never been an overland rescue of that magnitude. And, you know, these ships go up there. They know that as veteran Arctic whalers, they know they got to get out of there by November 1st or it will freeze. And they don't have the right kind of clothing for winter. They certainly don't have anywhere near enough food. The ice comes in solid on September 3rd. So they're stuck and they're going to die. And William McKinley, the president of the United States, gets word of this, and he knows there's no way. The closest you're going to be able to get to these guys is 1,800 miles. There's 400 of them. And you're going to have to walk it. And you're going to have to walk it at 60 below degrees. And you're going to have to walk it when it's mostly dark all day. And you're going to have to walk it in the worst terrain in the world. But even if you do that, even if by some miracle you get there, you still got to feed them, and you certainly can't. But I don't know if you want me to give it away at this point, Ms. Todd, but they find a way to do this.
This is, and of course, it's history, so we know how it ends up. But as I'm reading this in the beginning, I'm thinking, are they insane? I mean, really, this is really like a suicide mission. This is really an insane thing to ask somebody to do. So we've got the whalers who kind of realize the danger that they're in, and some of them leave the boats, and you know, some of them stay with the boats. But I mean, they're a bit of an unruly bunch.
Oh yeah, these are not your gentleman warriors. I mean, you know, these are rough, tough, hard drinking men who go off. And the most dangerous job in the world, chasing the greatest creatures in the world. They're hard-drinking men. They're very hard to control. But they can be at sea because they know that. But now you got them on land. Fortunately, there is a man who owns a whaling station right off of Point Barrow where these ships got marooned. And one of the great parts of this story, by the way, is what happens to these guys who do come ashore.
Yeah.
And the incredible adventure of keeping them alive before the rescue mission. And it's not easy. Right. These are thieves.
I was going to say, they steal from the dead.
Yeah, they steal from the dead. They find a cemetery. I mean,
dug up this guy, took his clothes, his mittens.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have to tell you, in all the brilliant and modest books I've done, there's one thing that's my criterion, and it's always I ask, you couldn't have made that up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, could you have this kind of a story? I mean, I'll tell you, I've always believed, and you know I've always said this to you, that if the story is right, and if you tell it right, it's so much better than anything fiction has to offer.
Well, you know, I have to say, if this was fiction, I'd be thinking there, oh, right, only in your imagination, you know, because you would never believe that you could accomplish what they do. So they have this crazy plan. At this time, the territory was unmapped, so locals really became critical to the success.
There's great heroes in this story. I mean, actually what happened is McKinley asked the Revenue Cutter Service, which is the forerunner to the Coast Guard, to mount the rescue. There's no chance, but we're gonna do it. And all along the way, there are great heroes. It's a story of incredible, you know. I mean, you started to allude to that. And, you know, as a practicing coward, I am truly in awe of all these guys. You know,
well,
I mean,
have to be.
Of course. Yeah. And they're a different breed of men. And so the three officers go, but they are accompanied from day one, from the time they mount the ship, through all the way by... there's always a controversy when you're an author, whether you call them Inuit or Eskimos, but by the natives there, by the indigenous people. And I have to tell you, one of the things I think I've contributed in this book is that, and boy, it's all about the research. You know?
Mm-hmm,
when you find
course,
a story like this, man, you just got to look and get as much out of it as you can. And there were some wonderful surprises. But what I found as more and more I did the research, the Native American, I'm sorry, the natives of Alaska were so looked down upon, and they have been treated so unfairly. And so I think one of the contributions of this book, these are real heroes. And these
absolutely.
People, one, well, we haven't talked about the reindeer yet. When
we'll get there,
we'll talk about
one of them. They're as brave and as giving as our three heroes here
exactly.
who come in for the rescue. But let's talk about the three volunteers, by the way, for this crazy mission. Let's start with David Jarvis. Tell us a little bit about David Jarvis.
Well, David Jarvis led an extraordinary life. I mean, David Jarvis was picked to command this impossible rescue because he had had experience in the Arctic. He spoke Inuit, and he had been up there before several times. you look at the pictures of him, and you read about his personality. He's a very unlikely hero. He's very mild-mannered. He's very small, but he turned out to be the perfect man to lead this because he led by example, and he was incredibly organized, as you had to be. And it's an incredible story. It's interesting. Any author who tells you that, well, I don't care what the review says, is lying. And every review that comes out, I hold at arm's length with one eye and say, it's going to be good. Now, fortunately, this book has got the greatest reviews, I think, in the history of publishing. I mean, it's got
And this is what, your 87th book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm old. But anyway. but
when you were, what, 5?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah. But the thing is that one of the things the reviewers picks up on has picked up on several of my books, and it's particularly true of this one, is that I always at the end say, what happened to them?
Mm-hmm.
And this is incredible because this is a man who leads this 1,800-mile suicide rescue. This is the man who, after he gets out, finds my job is just beginning. I got to keep these guys alive, these unruly guys alive, until a ship can come to us, and the darn ice just won't melt.
Right.
It's July, and the ice won't melt, you know? And then when this is all over and they get back, he goes within 2 months. He's up in Nome, Alaska, saving 130 other people who are starving to death. Mm. And then, and I guess I'm giving something away, but it's okay. What happens to him is after all these things, he finds out there's a lot of people starting to make a lot of money up in Alaska. So he goes to work for J.P. Morgan's interests up there. And then one day, it's almost like the poem Men of Achieving, one day he suddenly leaves and goes to the Seattle Athletic Club, books a room, puts a bullet in his head and dies. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's another great mystery.
Right.
But
you could write a whole book just on him.
Oh.
And this was a tough thing for him to. I mean, he volunteers for this. He realizes the danger. He's been there. He knows how impossible this sounds, and he's leaving his family behind.
He's leaving a pregnant wife behind,
which he's
in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Very torn as what to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But there's no question. There's an incredible sense of duty in him.
Yeah.
There's an incredible sense of duty. The guy I became fascinated with. There's three of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, the next one, Dr. Samuel Call.
Well, I'm in love with Dr. Samuel Call. There's a very specific reason why I'm in love with Dr.
Why?
Samuel Call. Well, number one, he's the surgeon. And number two, he's as brave as the other two. And number three, he performs incredible things. But while I'm doing the research, and again, it's all about research, I keep seeing these photographs. And, you know, I knew I had to illustrate it. And I say, well, that's a great photograph of the Arctic and about a kind of a rescue. And so maybe I can use it. And then I start realizing, wait a minute, that's got to be Jarvis. Wait a minute, that picture is depicting a scene that can only be in this. And so I keep looking and looking. And in the bowels of the New Bedford Whaling Museum and a couple other places, I finally discover, and this is, you know,
one of your big surprises.
One of my big surprises. Those pictures were all taken by Dr. Samuel Call. I mean, first of all, I've done 4 histories of photography. So the fact that with those cameras in 1897 in 50-degree below zero weather, he could get these pictures.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's full of great photos.
Well,
yeah.
The thing is, the whole adventure is documented.
Yeah.
I mean, my God. I mean, you know, today you can do it with your wristwatch, your telephone, you know, with your phone. But it's just incredible. So Call is a terribly, terribly important part. Now, he, like Jarvis, had been up there before. But, you know, he, and then, of course, once he gets up there, his job's just beginning. A lot of these guys are dying.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these guys are going to die.
They've got scurvy.
Oh, yeah, they sure do.
Yeah.
And everything else.
Yeah.
And he saves, and he...
And he's one guy, one doctor, with all of these people.
Mindy, these guys, I mean, talk about a different breed of men. Mm-hmm. These guys walk 1,800 miles. They get there. Now, about two-thirds of the men are in this whaling station, filthy and
disgusting, out of
control. The other third are still on some of the ships. After this 1,800 miles, Carl starts making daily trips, 300 miles out to the ships.
Yeah.
to treat them because there were
people who needed them.
Yeah,
and we should. And then we've got Second Lieutenant Ellsworth Berthoff. Is that
Berthoff?
His?
Yep. It's a very interesting story. Berthoff had been thrown out of the Coast Guard Academy on three different occasions. My kind of guy, for insubordination and pranks. But somehow he worked his way back into the graces, and he gets picked for this journey. But unlike Call and unlike Jarvis, he had never been to the Arctic. And it winds up, and actually he had said, and I've got the great quote in there, he said he's going up there to atone. He's going to prove himself. After mm-hmm. all the failures he's had, he's going to prove himself. And lo and behold, they have to split up. Jarvis doesn't want to do it, but he has to split the three of them up because he gets to a point where he's running out of supplies. And he's still got about 500 miles, the most treacherous 500 miles to go. So he sends Berthoff back to get supplies and take a different route, hoping mm-hmm. that when they get to a certain point, they'll meet. So here's Berthoff, who has never been in the Arctic before. And in many ways, he performs the greatest journey of all. So you really got, it's not just one journey,
right. It's
two.
Yeah, and also, too, the fact that if Berthoff isn't there when Jarvis needs him and is looking for him, it's all over.
It's all over.
So each of them had their role to play, and it's an absolute miracle that they all pulled off what they pulled off.
And what I got very lucky, as I've said it too many times, but it is all about the research. You got to find it. What I try to do in every one of my books is to, as much as I can, let the people in the story
tell the story.
Yep. So I got very fortunate here. Well, I say fortunate. I probably wouldn't have done the book if I hadn't been able to mm-hmm. find this stuff. But I found Jarvis's diary. And Jarvis not only keeps a day-by-day job, he actually can write. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as in other research I've done and other books I've done, you find the diary and say, oh, boy. And then you find out, oh, my God, you know, this is unintelligible, you know.
Or they make something about the weather and there's some big event that happened that day that they never wrote in the diary.
Mindy, that's exactly... I'll finish my point, even though I'm the great interrupter, and then I want to get to that because that's a good point. That's a great point. And there's Berthoff kept a journal, mm-hmm. and Call kept a journal. Mm-hmm. So I can really, but it's just wonderful because what I wanted to do is start off the book at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, thanks to the people there. They were able to give me the log of five of these ships, I should have known because I'd written books about whaling before. Here comes the log. Here are 300 entries, all the same. So starts the day. Sunny, wind 35 miles an hour, spotted two whales, lowered, got none, so ends the day. That's it. And as you say, maybe during that day, 17 guys got killed and the boat got sunk.
Right.
So ends the day.
Exactly.
So,
when you find
something that really... You know, where they're really telling the story. And, Jav, it's exciting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Marty Sandler. His new book is The Impossible Rescue, The True Story of an Amazing Arctic Adventure. Let's go back to the research for a second, because, and your history, you were a history teacher at one time. So this is why you have this love of history and being able to tell these stories that we don't often hear about or that we don't get told. So you find this adventure happens and you go, okay, am I going to write about this? That's where the research begins.
Yeah. And usually what happens is that I find out a germ of it. The germ gets planted in my head while I'm doing research for another book. So that suddenly, I mean, one of the best examples is I did a book called Trapped in Ice, but while I was researching, I kept just seeing one sentence here, something here about there was once a ghost ship and, you know, a whaling captain discovered it. And that's how the brilliant Resolute book that you and I have talked about on this show was born. This one, I had heard these stories before. What I You know, you got to tell it in a different way, or why tell it at all? Right. One of the ways is, can you find enough stuff so you're really letting the people in the story? But then can you find out other things that happened that haven't been told?
So tie it all together.
Yeah, and it can't be trivial. It's got to be important. But and I've just been very, very fortunate in this one because this is an extraordinary story. Mm-hmm. And as I would tell you, you couldn't make it up.
You couldn't make it up. So one of the things I thought was interesting, we talk about the cold. And, you know, we've been cold, but not that cold. I mean, that's pretty good. Those temperatures are you know, deadly. You can die. So you have to protect yourself from it. And I thought it was interesting just in the clothing. They took, you know, some advice from the native people there. And they wore deerskin pants with the hair inside against the skin. I wouldn't have thought of that. But it's interesting to see how they layered and how they dressed for this. And even still, you know, they were facing some pretty tough odds. And a lot of storms, it seemed like they'd just make some progress. And then they'd have to, you know, there'd be some storm that came in and they'd be stuck where they are for a couple of days. The weather was really brutal.
Oh, well, it always is. And you know, you have to be lucky, too. They had to be lucky. I mean, it is just one of the most amazing things about this story. They go 1,800 miles. We still got to get to the reindeer, but they go 1,800
that's
miles.
That's next.
they're herding 500 reindeer with them. They're falling into chasms. They're climbing mountains. There are blizzards where they have to go into these huts because they can't see the nose in front of their face.
Right.
Not one person got lost.
Right. As a matter of fact, there was one storm where Jarvis comes out and his dogs are buried up to their noses.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
and the dogs are a big part of the
of
story,
course,
by
yeah.
the way.
And
they're always having to replace these. That they're always having to double back because the dogs are played out. I mean, and they,
it's
the
a
dogs.
A lot of work
are,
for these dogs.
Hey,
pulling
they may
all
be
this
the true heroes of
right.
the story.
So, Jarvis has this chance encounter with George Fred Tilton, a whaler who's coming from Point Barrow. Think about how big this wilderness
right.
is, and ironically, they cross paths.
That's right.
So this is where he hears the condition of what's happening.
Yeah, when Jarvis, let me get to the reindeer just first so that
okay.
I stop referring to him. And
but the reindeer came after that, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but
okay.
but
all
they
right.
knew
right.
when they were left. The whole plan was this. They knew from the beginning that it was almost impossible to get there. And they also knew from the beginning that if they got there, so what if you can't feed them? But there were two reindeer stations they knew along the way. And in the most extraordinary idea, I mean, it really is. It's unprecedented.
Another one, you go, what?
Exactly. You couldn't make it up because the plan is that they've got to not only walk 1,800 miles in these conditions, they've got to talk the two reindeer owners, one of them whom is an Indian, an Eskimo, the only Eskimo, reindeer-owning Eskimo in the world probably. They've got to talk them into giving up their herds, their lifeblood.
Yep.
Yeah, giving up that to save these whalers.
Yep.
And they do it, and so it's not just that they're walking 1,800 miles. They're having the herd 800. Now, one of the reindeer station owners, a guy named Tom Lopp, who's yet another hero of this story, mm-hmm. he says, yes, he'll go with them and herd the reindeer over ice that sometimes breaks, over mountains.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're talking, you, as usual, Ms. Todd, you've picked up one of the great moments in this story because you're right. They're about halfway there, and all of a sudden, with nothing in front of them, to the side of them, and in back of them, but sheer ice and snow and white, here in the distance comes a sled. And it's a guy named Tilton, Fred Tilton, Bigfoot Tilton, because he's got big feet, and that's what they call him. The people on the ships back there who are stranded and on in the whaling station have said, we're never going to get rescued. We're going to die up here. So they picked Tilton to make this improbable mission. He's going to walk all the way to the closest he can get to where he can get a ship and then take off where he can finally get some help.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they bump into it. You could not make,
you could not
like,
make it up. You're right.
And
right.
what Tilton, when Tilton says, who are you and what are you doing? He says, I'm out to rescue. He says, well, I'm from there. I have made journeys that no other person has made. And he looks at this Jarvis, who weighs about 89 pounds soaking wet, and says, you're not going to make it. Yeah. You're going to die. And if you think you can get reindeer all the way up there. And so they part, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and in the brilliant what happened to them, I talk about what happened to this guy Tilton. And that's another whole journey.
Yeah, another book.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the reindeer for a second, too, because it's just herding those reindeer over these dangerous conditions. But also, is it some of they get pregnant at a certain point, the breeding
exactly.
season. And so
yeah.
so you now you've got a deadline. If you don't get the reindeer by this certain time, they're not going to be moving. Because once breeding season starts, that's it. They stop.
You, absolutely. So that just adds to the, you know, that it,
yeah,
I always know when I'm being interviewed by Mindy Todd. She's the one person who actually reads the book before we talk. Go ahead.
Well, and one of the things I thought was really interesting, too, is, and people might get a kick out of this, is the dog sled versus the reindeer sled.
Yeah.
So you've got these guys who they don't have a lot of experience with either. So first they're learning how to do the dog sled, and they pick it up pretty quickly. Reindeer sled's a little
That's
bit
right.
more of a problem.
But what happens is that the dogs keep playing out. The dogs are heroic. But, you know, you take dogs 300 miles over the ice, their feet start getting
Yeah,
so
they tried putting boots,
booties
on
absolutely.
Them. It didn't work.
No.
Yeah.
And they get exhausted. Mm-hmm. And they're told as they go up, the only way you've got any chance of making it is that from this particular point, Cape Blossom, from this particular point on, you got to use reindeer sleds because the reindeer will move quicker and they will be hardier and so forth. But managing her. And, you know, the first day out, you know, they have incredibly funny adventures where they get
It would be funny if it wasn't so serious
yeah,
at the time. Looking back, it's funny.
Well, two days later, Jarvis comes as close as he comes in the whole trip of dying.
Right.
Because the deer just takes off. And then and he has this terrible crash into a tree and he survives. But Berthoff, the same thing. When Berthoff goes off on his own separate journey, he gets to a point where they tell him at Golovin Bay, they tell him that, you know, you can't go any further with these dogs. You've got to take reindeer sled. And but again, he gets lucky.
Yeah.
They say we'll provide them.
Yeah.
You know?
It's amazing. I mean, when you're talking about that accident that Jarvis had, and I thought, wow, you know, you're just this close away from a very serious accident, and you're out in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, it's all over.
And
you're
I mean,
you're
if any of
there.
Them had gotten seriously hurt,
that's right.
That's it.
That's
it's
right.
done.
Yeah.
So, of course, frostbite's a big concern, and they do have issues with frostbite. Many of them there. Let's talk about when they get there. They finally make it, and here they come with all their reindeer. And Jarvis sees the conditions that these men are living in.
Yeah.
And he says, This is really bad.
Well, because they're filthy. There's another great hero in this story, and you know, it's the man who has the whaling station and takes him in. But you know, there's only so much he can do. And in typical fashion, the minute all of these whalers get on shore with their officers, the whaling captains just what? Mm-hmm. I shouldn't use the word wash because nobody washes, but he washes his hands of them.
Mm-hmm.
He says, okay, you're not under my jurisdiction anymore. So there's nobody to control them, and they are out of control. Now, there's another interesting character there. I've always liked McElhaney's Tabasco sauce. Why, you ask, are you now talking about McElhaney's Tabasco sauce? There is when those eight ships get stranded in the ice, two men see them. One is the whaling station owner. The other is a guy named Ned McElhaney. Ned McElhaney, I mean, now talk about, you could do another book. Ned McElhaney was one of the members of the family that had the Tabasco sauce company back there in 1897. Still today, the one great Tabasco company, sauce company. He got sick of working in tobacco sauce. He wanted adventure. And so he got a deal with the University of Pennsylvania to collect artifacts up at Point Barrow.
Mm.
And up he goes just in time to look out and see eight whale ships get stranded like this, and three of them sink as it happens. And so he and the whaling station owner are in charge of taking care of these guys.
If it weren't for them, they'd be dead.
Well, they would be dead. But by the time Jarvis gets up there and Colin, by the time they get up there, these guys, they've
rough
had
shape,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these guys are filthy and they're ill and there is absolutely no discipline. And can you imagine, Mindy, getting stuck in the ice and you're there the whole winter. Now it gets to be June. Nothing's
still
melting.
Icy.
Now it gets to be July. Nothing's melting. Yeah. Now, another part of the story is that these guys were, Jarvis and Colin Berthold, were brought up as far as they could get by the Revenue Cutter Service's best ship, the Bear.
Mm-hmm.
The captain of the Bear was Francis Tuttle. Now, once Tuttle leaves them off, he's got to get the heck out of there because his ship will sink. Up.
And he's waiting for it to melt to get back in.
Yeah, he's way back, you know, 800 miles away, waiting for it. It won't melt. Finally, in July, he says, I got to get up there. On the way up, he comes terribly close to getting sunk by ice. When he gets up there and they finally can see, here's a rescue ship. It's now August. It's getting hammered by ice, and it looks like it's never going to get out. And even when they finally get the men aboard the ship to try to get them home, they can't get out.
Yeah.
So it's an adventure that just... I'll tell you one of the great ironies, too. One of the great ironies is that I don't think that was... Certainly in those days, there was not ever a greater adventure than that.
Right.
When it finally got known of what had happened, it was like on the 13th page, because... The first 12 pages were about the Spanish-American War, which had broken out just when those ships got there.
So this is another reason why we don't know a lot about the story. And just in the final last 40 seconds or so, one of the things that Jarvis, this little guy that, you know, sort of mild-mannered, takes charge. He comes in, he cleans up the living conditions, he controls them, and with exercise, he gets them on this
they sort play of, baseball
on
the ice.
They're playing baseball, they're walking, and he really just kind of turns this place around.
Yes,
he does.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle he got there. It's a miracle what he did and how he kept them all alive.
Right.
And, you know, you couldn't make it up.
You couldn't make it up. Marty Sandler, his new book is The Impossible Rescue, the true story of an amazing Arctic adventure with all those great photographs from Dr. Call and, as you said, being able to read their journals. You're going to be at Books by the Sea in Osterville Saturday, October 13th for the book launch, 3 to 5. Marty, always fun to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening. The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH.